The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by Exchange Wire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Anne-Marie Sheedy, CRO at Exchange Wire, and I'm thrilled to be joined by Madeline Farrington, Head of Client Solutions at Kinesso. Hello, Madeline.
Hello, Anne-Marie. Great to be here.
Delighted to have you. And also, hot on the heels of being at Interact, IAB Interact in Milan, we have none other than Rachel Smith, CEO Exchange Wire. Welcome back, Rachel. Hello.
Hi there. Yes, it was a very rainy couple of days in Milan. And then just as the weather started to get good, I landed in London where it was also really rainy. So following me around.
It's actually quite rainy in Singapore at the moment. So maybe there's something going on globally.
There's a rain vortex.
Brilliant. Well, let's crack on. We've got three great stories that I'd like to talk to you about and get your viewpoints. And the first one comes from TechCrunch. It's where Netflix are set to take on Google and Amazon by building their own ad server. So they announced the launch of its ad tech platform, and it stated that this move pits it against other industry heavyweights with ad servers such as Google, Amazon, and Comcast. It stated that by developing its own ad server, Netflix aims to have greater control over its ad operations, improving ad targeting, and enhance the overall ad experience for both advertisers and viewers. Now, to me, it indicates Netflix's broader strategy to expand its business model to sustain growth and remain competitive. But Madeline, I'd like to come to you first. And please, can you tell us, how do you think this will impact the kind of the streaming landscape?
Honestly, my first thought when I read this story was, as an advertising specialist, was, oh God, the last thing anyone wants or needs, and I thought we'd move past, was more ad servers. So that was my media specialist background. But as a brand and as a consumer, I think it's really important for Netflix to be considered in their approach to their ad-funded model. You know, for me, sitting in Singapore, the ad-funded model hasn't rolled out, in great scale in this part of the world. So ad-funded opportunities in APAC are still very limited. What's really important for Netflix, again, very, very close competition between the likes of Prime Video, Disney, and Netflix, of course, as well as a lot of local players you see in the region, a lot of switching, a lot of low loyalty. So being able to maintain, that experience and that user experience is just so fundamental for them to retain that audience base and to grow. So producing a model that allows them to, retain control over that, super important. But I think it also acts as a qualification in the types of clients who are going to be participating in that ecosystem. Because to be able to do so, you'll need to be very, diligent and organized in terms of the types of content that you're creating. And again, it is a huge investment in time to add in another completely different ecosystem. So by doing that, I think it acts as a pre-qualifier for them in the types of clients that they're looking to interact with on that. So in summary, I think good for Netflix, definitely good for anybody on the platform.
Bad for those in agencies.
Well, bad's a negative word. I would say, I would actually say worrisome. So yes, not great as a media professional, but if it makes sense and you have a big client that you want to have a dedicated approach to Netflix, then, sure, you can look at building that out in the right detail.
Rachel, what would you like to add to that?
Yeah, that's so interesting because, I feel like it's been a while since we've heard of platforms and whether it's broadcasters or whether it's others sort of bringing their advertising stack in-house and building out their own ad server. This feels like this is the first that we've seen for quite a while. Was a fashion there for a little while because it is such a huge undertaking, right? But Netflix is the type of organization that has got the the financial power to be able to make something like this happen, and also probably to be able to make that advertising experience for advertisers really good quality. So I like your point, Madeline, about it being a pre-qualifier. You know, who are the types of advertisers is this going to attract to the platform? And, you know, you can imagine that those advertisers are super keen on getting in front of Netflix audiences in regions where Netflix is, where their ad model is much more prevalent. Interestingly, I was chatting about this in the office last week with a few people. What I've noticed them do here in the UK, and I presume they've done it in other European markets and probably also in the US, is they've automatically shunted a whole bunch of their customers onto an ad-funded model, which I thought was quite a neat way of making sure that you've got a huge amount of people taking up your ad-funded tier. Because looking into this article, it was also giving you some numbers on the growth of their ad-supported tier, which has been very healthy and speedy. And I'm sure part of that is to do with this strategy. So, you know, you get an email into your inbox saying, or a notification somewhere saying, great news, your Netflix subscription is just about to go down by 35% a month. And you're like, whoa, this is great. What's happening here? Oh, you're going to show me ads. I see. And so, you know, so many things go on in that transaction, right? The first is, has anyone seen the message? Do they have the time and the energy and the effort to do something about it? Or will they just stick on the ad supported tier? For those of us that work in the industry, it's like, great, I get to test the ad supported tier. Let's see what this is going to be like. For those who are price sensitive, they're probably thinking, excellent, I was just about to cancel my subscription or think twice about it. So this really suits me down to the ground. So it's an ingenious way of making sure that you've got a really strong pool of people to show those ads to. You add that together with their capability for showing good quality ads and building their own ad server, which definitely enables them to have more control and to gather data and use and apply it in a particular way, things could start to get really interesting. And I'm pretty sure within the article, or was it somewhere else that I read something about this morning, they're also looking at trialing the notion of episode ads. So the idea that you will tell a story in an episodic format. And, you know, Netflix, you can imagine, is the platform on which to try that. And I think that could be a really interesting new ad format. So I think it's all to play for. You know, they've got the money and they've got the customers, I think, to make this really interesting. And it does seem, Madeline, like the last thought is how awkward or, you know, sort of inconvenient is it going to be for those that are trying to execute the campaigns? But, you know, are we not on the cusp of some other kind of, I don't know, AI tool that's just going to make that easier? So maybe, you know, maybe this will actually provide a bit of focus on the ways in which we pull together and construct all of our advertising campaigns from a media agency point of view. And maybe there's some, you know, efficiencies to be gained there.
And you know what I love about that? It's always that dichotomy with who I am as a media professional, thinking about connecting with audiences, content. I think everyone was so excited when, you know, Netflix ads were coming out. And then who we all are as people, which, you know, dare I say, nobody's putting their hands up, usually saying, oh, this is great news. We're getting more ads. But that comes down to user experience, and it comes down to the expectation of individuals that digital ads are annoying and I'm going to see some random stuff. But if you actually think about it, people still love ads, and the moments where people love ads are things like the Super Bowl, things like when you go to the movies and you're expecting to see something great. So, you know, maybe Netflix is making advertising great again by forcing people to be quite, you know, creative and to be forcing that innovation. So this could be a really great thing for the right advertiser to spend the time to create really great content and engage people back in that category and just, you know, reshape that, I think is super exciting.
Yeah, and I'm also interested to see what it might do to viewing habits, right? I feel like, you know, I'm a watcher exclusively of streamed TV. I don't watch any terrestrial TV. So ads feel like a very foreign concept these days, and I only ever come across them if I'm watching some kind of live streamed TV from a broadcasting channel that shows ads. And but I'm not averse to the idea of consuming ads again, as long as they're good quality, as long as they're engaging. And I'm really interested to see if that's going to create more of a tolerance in in and amongst consumers for ad-funded content? I know there's still a hell of a lot of consumers that either are still consuming terrestrial version TV, or even really young consumers that are consuming a lot of TV on channels and platforms that have shown ads for a long time, YouTube, for example. But I feel like there's also a whole bunch of consumers that have been skipping ads for like years now. So it'd be really interesting to see what this advertising experience does to them.
I'm curious to get your thoughts on, you talk about the content, you talk about the consumers, the environments. You mentioned YouTube there, Rachel, as an example. Different audiences are consuming different content on different platforms, right? So regardless of the advertising experience. But I think Netflix are trying to compete with the likes of Google, YouTube and Amazon, saying that they've got that they're looking for premium content environments. Now, why, you know, is that a bit of an assumption? Because anecdotally, people are saying there's not much on Netflix these days. The content hasn't been there. And in particular, Madeline, I'm curious to get your viewpoint or any thoughts you can share with our listeners around the kind of the fragmented regional content that you and your peers are challenged with targeting, you know, different players in different markets. It's a bit like people kind of assuming everyone in Europe is the same. It's very different. At the beginning of this conversation, you also talked about different players, so Prime Video or Disney, etc. Is there anything you can share in terms of, and you also finally said there's low loyalty. So what kind of opportunity do you think Netflix has in terms of competition with these players in this market? And what should they be considering, assuming that they've got fantastic ad experience?
So if I'm looking at a market like APAC, that's a big one. Maybe we focus on a market like Southeast Asia, where there is a lot of fragmentation with users. You see, Indian content being very strong. You see a lot of Korean content, a lot of Thai content, local users looking for local types of content. There's a lot of switching. I know that, you know, that's something that Prime Video invests in very heavily. Then you've also got, you know, your big sort of tier one global franchises, and that's where you'll often see a lot of switching as well. So I think creating content that creates a compelling and competitive reason to pull people into the platform. Obviously, Disney got very big by associating with the Marvel franchise, and they've grown out from that. What I actually think is really interesting is the concept of brands creating that entertainment. Now, I personally, looking outside of streaming, I watch a lot of TikTok. Now, when I say I don't watch TV, I don't even watch stream. I personally consume a lot of TikTok, probably too much. but what I think is so interesting, and when I talk to clients about using TikTok, to me, it has to be authentic. And when I see brands who get it, who participate on TikTok and tell a great story in a voice and tone that makes sense to their brand, that is a really exciting connection point. So when I think about the opportunity for Netflix and for media and for brands and for clients and for consumers, not everything is a reach play. And that's where our industry often goes back to, how do we get reach? How do we get cheap CPMs? There's always a concern around pulling CPMs down as low as possible. But maybe it's that play of having a really great experience of letting brands be creators and telling a compelling story and creating a place for them. And yes, that can also be really positive through that opportunity with ad-funded content. So just pushing brands to be more creative and to be excited and to see it as something that they want to choose to invest in to build that ongoing, platform of who are we? What does the community want to build? What are the stories we want to tell? And that doesn't make sense for every client all the time. But again, I don't think that's the angle that Netflix is going down by, you know, them putting the qualifications in place that they are around their ad server, around needing, you know, episodic content, those sorts of parts. So for brands who want to be able to tell a more interesting or a deep or a new story, who want to create audiences, who want to have their Super Bowl moment or their TikTok moment, I think as well, that you see these days, that's again, shifting the conversation. Not everything's about reach, and it might not be about being on Netflix all the time. When you've got something important to tell, that can be, you know, a period of time that you look at investing and building out that content in a really considered way. And that I think is a really exciting opportunity for brands.
I bet you're going to be excited about the 60-minute or the long-form content that TikTok are now going to release.
You know, personally, I'm not. I love
it. I was just going to say, if you're a real lover of TikTok as it is, you'll be like wanting the diversity, right? And being able to scroll from one thing to another.
And I think it's about training your brain that you get, which is why I think you get a little dopamine hit when you scroll through. And I even see the way my 2-year-old daughter goes through YouTube on her iPad when she's got it. It's frightening. But I do think a lot of that on TikTok is that short, sharp hit of something really exciting and concise. To me, wanting to look at, but again, told in a really interesting and creative and authentic way. I always say to me, TikTok is so interesting because it's a platform built purely off insights. It's almost as though everything you watch is such an insightful commentary on society, on people, on a specific, you know, subculture, but it's told in such a short and sharp way. Again, that being applicable, I personally wouldn't have that expectation to see that sort of content there. But if we're going back to the Netflix example, I do have an expectation of being entertained, of having premium content, of having something that I want to lean into. So to me, there's very different roles and opportunities, but the core principle is the same. Create content that is authentic to your brand, that makes sense for your audience, that's considered and thoughtful. And in the places and spaces that they're having those opportunities, that creates, you know, something much deeper and richer for you to do than just to get, you know, cheap reach, cheap CPMs, viewable CPMs. You know, media is more than that.
Very true. And on that note, I'm going to move on to the next story, which is focusing on the short and the sharp, perhaps. It's from Google's blog, and it's about generative AI in search. Let Google do the searching for you is how it's positioned. So if you haven't heard, Google has unveiled an updated AI-enhanced version of its search. AI overviews will provide AI-generated answers, which appear at the top of a user's results page. Google Search will also incorporate new planning capabilities, which can customize desired adjustments to its results. And the move marks a shift in Google's attempts to get ahead in the AI race. Now, I think it's important to note that despite these advancements, Google is reassuring people that traditional search results would continue to coexist with AI-generated summaries, emphasizing that web links remain crucial for direct traffic to publishers and creators. Taking this into consideration, Rachel, I'm going to come to you first, and I'm going to ask what you make of Google's search updates, please.
So I thought this was very interesting. We've known for quite some time that Google are obviously aggressively leaning into protecting their search business. It underwrites to a certain extent, to a large extent, the popularity of their advertising business. It is essential. A good search experience is essential to keeping people in a Chrome environment. Those are people that you can be showing ads to, whether that's on within search results or whether that's elsewhere within Chrome. So making sure that search is still a great experience and is still the go-to place for entering the internet is critically important to Google. So I'm not surprised that they will be throwing everything they possibly can at making search amazing. Now, what is also interesting, we've been chatting a lot about whether, you know, large language models and generative AI would replace search, because certainly that's how ChatGPT is being used a lot and other LLMs, because it provides you with a richness of, arguably, because it provides you with a richness of results, and you can do things like ask it quite complicated, complex questions and get a lot of detailed information back, right? Yep. It's sort of the, you know, it's the de facto modern encyclopedia, which is what search was when it first came along, but AI is better, LLMs anyway, are better. Mm-hmm. So we've been talking a lot about how Google was, you know, well, anyone that runs a search business or a search engine will be wanting to compete with AI language models and generative AI models. And so it's not surprising that Google have poured a bit of money into setting something up that brings those two things together. What is interesting about this, from my point of view, is that the way that they've presented it sounds like it's going to make search amazing. The idea that you could be asking a search engine compound questions, getting AI results as well as basic search results, sounds really interesting to me, because it will lean into the idea of using it as a replacement for the general questions that you would have typically gone to a search engine for. So it's no longer just, you know, where is Honey & Co. because I'm going there for lunch. It is, where is Honey & Co. because I'm going there for lunch and I'm in Farringdon at the moment, so what's the best train to catch and what time do I need to leave? And that's awesome. That's what you need in your life, right? Remember how amazing Google Maps was when it became, you know, when it became brilliant and, again, the de facto mapping app of our lives? Imagine if search could be as multifaceted as any other AI tool that we're typically using at the moment. So bringing the two things together sounds really interesting. The type of features that they're looking at focusing on sound really interesting. If they get them right, I think they could really corner a very large share of the market, which are all the people that use Chrome and that haven't yet really gotten very involved in ChatGPT or any other AI chat models. And as long as they're putting enough money into this as quickly as possible, this could be a really interesting product. There might be lots of competitors and lots of reasons why people want to use other versions of this or want to keep their search activity separate from their activity that they use LLMs for. But ultimately, if you make this easy and convenient enough for people and smart enough for people, and it really is the sort of thing that you can use on the go to enhance your day-to-day life, they'll do very well out of this.
Surprise, surprise, as if they're not doing well enough. Madeline, what are your thoughts, please?
Personally, I am a Gemini person. I just love it. And I think to Rachel's point, it is fundamentally changing search behaviors. It's fundamentally changing the way that I would ask something on Gemini is very different to the way that you search on, you know, regular Google search. And it's also Google's, you know, unique capability is around their convergence of their properties. Because if Google wasn't in enough parts of our lives, they found a way to be in more. So again, it's that ability to search, to pull that through to email, to pull that through to your calendar, to make suggestions, to understand the types of things you've been searching with previously, to pull that together. What the concern would be, apart, again, I love Gemini. That's where I do all my searching now. The concern would be, you know, the removal of that independent thought and consideration around where I'm choosing to get my information from. When I'm going through search results, and I think something we're all taught in school is how do you critically assess where you're receiving that information from. The problem when we start leaning too heavily into AI is that we're taking these results on face value. And we know that AI is trained on pulling together what exists on the internet, which at times can often be troubling. So while still super convenient, if we're leaning too heavily into these areas, it creates an over-reliance on receiving and accepting the information we're giving at face value, which is extremely concerning. So being able to find a balance between, you know, independent verification of the types of information we're receiving and still prompting for, you know, independent search beyond that, but also the convenience, the value in Google being able to pull that information together and very complex parts of information together in short periods is very, very satisfying for individuals, definitely for me.
Do you think there's anyone else that can challenge them?
I was going to say, honestly, I don't. I think AI exists in different areas, and I don't think anyone's AI is, you know, perfect. Everyone's got an AI that works for them. I see it in my WhatsApp, you know, as part of Meta. I see it in my Facebook. I see it in my Instagram. I see it in, then you've got your separate types of AI. You've got OpenAI AI. You've got other parts around Midjourney. Everything is shifting to AI, and it should enhance the capabilities that you already use a platform for. But I fundamentally believe generally as society, we've progressed so heavily, probably obviously the likes of not China and maybe South Korea still have some hope with Naver, not to go down that route. But generally as a society, we have just built ourselves so heavily on the Google stack. I just can't imagine anyone challenging you know, the prevalence and the dominance of that in our lives. And you know, the same issues, I think, still exist in other ecosystems beyond Google.
Yeah. I mean, I think, is there anyone that could challenge them from the point of view of engineering capability, market position, to sort of bring some like-for-like products forward? I think the competitors would be slim. There's a couple of companies with deep enough pockets and with a lot of engineers, but are they already actually in that space or not? You know, Google's definitely got the first mover advantage here. I think the thing that will come up as a challenge to them, though, connected a little bit to some of the things you just said there, Madeline, earlier on, which is the concern around what information is being shown via any, you know, AI large language model applications, whether it's accurately sourced, whether it's giving credit to where any of that information came from, how it then upholds the integrity of some of the publications and the writers and journalists that have produced that information or not, how it assists them to fund those businesses, all of that sort of stuff. I think that's where we'll start to get into tricky territory, definitely. And what we might find is that there are regional complexities. So in some regions, Google's products will be the de facto operational products for internet access and for finding out information. In other regions, they may well find they don't have access in exactly the same way. And that's where we'll start to see some competitors pop up as well. And this is not going to be straightforward because Google have already got a high volume of anti-competition complaints brought against them for their practices within advertising and specifically their advertising technology stack and their approach to privacy protection, consumer data protection, etc. And I don't think that, let's see how that unfolds this year. There's lots of predictions about how those privacy complaints are about to get very real for Google, both in the US and also over here in Europe in general and specifically in the UK. Let's see how that shakes out this year and what that does to Google's ad tech stack. I think it's going to be a very important year for them. And depending on the outcome of those complaints and those court cases, you might see governments with a much greater interest in making sure that there isn't too little competition in this field. And that's when you might start seeing some credible challenges pop up. I think it's not just about how good are the products that they've currently got and how much of a stronghold have they got on the way that we live our lives. I think the question will start to be being asked, well, who else out there could innovate and can develop something similar? And can we encourage a free and open market where we can see a range of products and a diversity of products? Because before too long, we will otherwise back ourselves into a corner where there really is only one company. And they're a company that also produce hardware as well as software. And didn't we get to that place with Apple back in the late 80s? So, you know, I sort of feel like it's not going to be a straightforward path.
That'll be boring. Hopefully not.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully not. That would be boring. Both of those statements.
You both make comments there that feed into our third story, one around regional complexity, one around everything shifting to AI. And our third story is from the rest of the world. And it's entitled, Writers and Publishers in Singapore Reject a Government Plan to Train AI on Their Work. So Singaporean writers have pushed back against their government's request to use their work to train a LLM, large language model. According to this article, Singapore has set out to create its own LLM, intending to train it on material produced locally. However, the writers claim that there is little clarity on how their material will be used or how they will be compensated. So, Madeline, how valid do you feel are these writers' concerns?
It's a good segue because the last point that Rachel made was starting to talk about policy. And of course, as we know with, you know, data and as we know with technology and it moves so quickly and the policy doesn't exist the way it should when it should to protect people. But I mean, the concerns are completely valid, of course. For people who have, you know, creative livelihoods, making sure that they're protected, making sure that it's not automation at all costs is so important. Maintaining, you know, creative, original and free thought, and allowing individuals to continue to own their intellectual property should be the single biggest concern that we all have, through generative AI, and finding the sweet spot between automation, between process efficiencies, between how we use AI to complement, not to replace, is a huge concern for society. Because again, the types of people who are going to be cut out of roles, I don't think that there's going to be the same volume of roles available to all to replace those. So there's just because we can doesn't mean we should very much still applies. Being thoughtful, being considerate, understanding, you know, the societal, the cultural impacts of taking anybody's intellectual property and giving that over to technology. Because as we know, that is just a learning model. It doesn't have the ability, at least as we know right now, for independent thought, analysis and distillation. It lacks empathy. It lacks, you know, any type of life experience. It lacks cultural nuance. So for a government, for an individual, for anybody really to be so focused and dedicating on protecting that is so important. And this is coming from a huge AI, generative AI lover. Finding the sweet spot and finding a place, I think for now at least, where we can use it to support the independent work that people are doing is super important. Not let's forge ahead with creating and slimming down the workforce and cutting costs and efficiencies any way we can. And that's sort of the place that you're seeing in tech at the moment already. It's quite a bloodbath, huge sheddings of workforces, huge sheddings of capabilities and investments, and at any cost, at the cost of shareholder return. So I don't think anyone's necessarily safe from that at the moment, but as much as possible, I think talking about the fact of how dangerous that can be is very, really important.
Yeah, you're right. I think the pushback kind of really highlights the ongoing global debate, really, about balancing that the tech advancement and the rights and protections of individuals and creative professionals. Rachel, what would you like to add to this?
So I think that that, you know, interpretation that you shared with us there, Madeline, absolutely underscores the point of this, shall we say, for the moment, disagreement between the Singapore government and, you know, journalists and writers there in Singapore. I think that it's really good that we're seeing this and that it's being exposed in the media as well, because Singapore perhaps is a country that is known for you know, having a sympathetic outlook towards China and China's, you know, sort of political progress, but is in and of itself obviously an independent democracy. So it works very hard to uphold that. But there is a degree of censorship that is undertaken in the media there that I think journalists and writing professionals in Singapore are very sensitive to. So it's not, you know, nobody claims that isn't what happens, but it's also not the same as a fully censored state. We are talking about a free and open press, but we are talking about a fairly controlled government approach to that. So it's really good to see this debate popping up. You know, the government saying, we're going to train our own large language model and we want to be using the content of our journalists and writers to inform that. And those journalists and writers saying, hang on a minute, not sure how comfortable we feel about that. Principally, I must underscore here, speaking not as a Singaporean or a resident of Singapore, they haven't said anything about their concerns regarding censorship, but they're raising legitimate concerns about their, you know, the integrity of the information, where it's coming from, how they're compensated for it and how it's sourced, which is, as you've rightly pointed out, the big concern for everybody using generative AI tools. So Where this actually goes, I think, is the interesting thing to ponder. Will it become an open debate? Will it be something that the Singaporean government then spend a lot of time looking at in a bit more detail? Because it is a challenge that has fallen at the feet of every single government in any developed country at the moment. And I think the future of our society depends somewhat on how we're dealing with this current inflection of tech versus, you know, society. And I think this will be a really important point in history. How have we, the point at which, you know, artificial intelligence became so baked into our lives that it changed everything? What did that look like? What routes did we go down? What paths did we choose when it came to things like regulation, control, setting up some guardrails? And that's not all going to happen, obviously, this year or in the next 6 months or within the advertising industry or marketing industry, but it's going to be really interesting next few years to see how all of this shakes out with the pace of development of AI tools and to see what the actual real practical debate looks like. And I think this particular article focusing on the government and its journalists and writers in Singapore is a really interesting use case for that. I'm fascinated to see where it's going to go next and, you know, what the outcome's going to be. And at the end of the day, it won't surprise any listeners to know, you know, obviously here at Exchange Wire, we're huge supporters of the whole point and purpose behind independent thought-led journalism. That is what upholds our society. And we think at ExchangeWire, that's what upholds our content, right? You know, we put a lot of effort into producing original content and it's all correctly sourced and it's all accurately pieced together. And that, you know, that is produced by expert content writers who are you know, who rightly need to be compensated for that activity. So anything that supports that, we're a big fan of. Yeah, I've just got John, our head of content, in the background in the office, giving me a thumbs up for that.
And that's it. And that's the conversations that we're having today. We're not going to get, at least I don't think in the immediate short term, we're not going to have AI jump onto a podcast and start to talk about that. They don't have, you know, it's who you are as a person, who you are in the context of, you know, the experiences you've had as a individual, as a career person, what you learn from the people around you. So that is something that's fundamentally missing from, you know, the over application, I think, of AI and using AI to generate new stories and new information. It's going to have a very limited view on what that means. And of course, you know, as someone who lives in Singapore and has done so for the past 6 years, one thing about the government is they are very technically progressive. So I think there's always that hunger and ambition from the Singapore government to being at the cutting edge of innovation and technology. And that's definitely the place for themselves that they've cemented in the world. But then, of course, like anyone at the moment, how do you navigate what's right for, you know, for journalism as an industry? But what does that also mean for Singaporeans? And that is something that the government is very focused on. How do we continue to create and develop opportunities for Singaporeans to protect themselves and create, you know, careers and to grow that further? So it will be very interesting to see how that develops.
I mean, a great testbed country for that, right? Because like you said, Madeline, the you know, the government is very, you know, sort of tech first and tech focused. So I think it's a really good place to start testing some of those thoughts around policy, regulation, how much, you know, how much protection needs to be in place, what types of controls need to be applied to technical businesses and technical organizations, but how do you find that sweet spot to enable innovation and growth and development? And, you know, that's one of the reasons why we love doing business in Singapore. ATS Singapore, everybody, July the 3rd, make sure you're there. Because it is such an outward-looking environment, right? It's not just a hub for APAC. It's a very outward-looking society and an outward-looking place.
Indeed. And what a positive way to finish up this conversation, because sadly we're out of time. Ladies, thank you both very much for your time and your opinion and your contribution. It's really interesting. And listeners, thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. Until next time.